I've been watching the birds in my backyard, and I have a feeder so I can see them as they come. And there's a huge hawk that keeps appearing and screaming from the far edge of the forest. So all I could think was, oh, there are these fabulous birds. I should tell them about these birds. The Dharma of the birds. I met with someone the other day who just came back from New Zealand and had a really wonderful time. He said it was the most beautiful country he had ever been in his whole life. I've heard that before. He said there's nothing dangerous there. The people, there are hardly any people, and they're all very, very mellow. Nobody's upset about anything. They have no poisonous snakes. They don't have any snakes at all, I think, and no dangerous animals. You can walk out in the forest and nothing will try to eat you. he said the only real danger is that you'll step in a sheep pie. Yes, he said there are thousands of sheep everywhere. And he had a whole month vacation there. He's a Vipassana practicer. And so he found himself applying what's called mindfulness to his experience. Mindfulness has a lot of different meanings. One is to just pay attention to where you are, exactly what you're doing and nothing else, which means your mind is constantly flowing and changing as your life is flowing and changing. In the present moment, as the present moment becomes the next moment. Sometimes it's a kind of concentration practice. If you're doing something, slicing an onion, you can be extremely focused and mindful of just that one activity, which includes the whole thing, your breath and your tears if you're affected by it, and then the whole ambiance of the room and out into your world and out to the edges of the universe. Another kind of mindfulness is attending to what's going on in your own mind as you're present wherever you are. Because, of course, there are thoughts running through our mind all the time. And that's the kind of mindfulness that he was practicing. Just watching what he was thinking rather than being engaged in it, hooked by his thoughts. And he said it was so surprising to him how much of it he had never really listened to or examined before. And he's been practicing a long time, and he's a very wide awake person. He said, you know, all those old conditionings, all those old claims on us, all the directions that we get from everyone when we're small and helpless and need direction and need help, and how deeply we take in those instructions. And how we carry them with us, whether they're still relevant or not. And often they're not relevant at all. And he was astonished by how much he carried that was still leftover stuff. He said, when I'm busy doing what I do, and he works very hard, he said, I just have no sense of that, those things going on at all. But once there was leisure, he began to listen and to attend to what he was being told and to how he acted on that advice often. Acted in relationship even though it wasn't really applicable. Chanting the Metta Sutra this morning, I was taken by the very last part of it, talking about freed from the duality of birth and death. And one of the things that our conditioning gives us is duality, the rightness and wrongness of things. That's what they tried to teach us when we were small. Do this, but don't do this. This is right, this is definitely wrong. And so, because our mind is already dualistic, it's the way our thinking runs as human beings, and especially in English, we because we posit an I, not every language has an I, we have a especially dualistic kind of conditioning. So it's hard for us to even conceive of a situation that isn't either or. And because of that, I think we suffer greatly sometimes. Often if there's a question, a decision to make, we have a default position, and the default position is no. So what my friend was saying was very interesting. He brought up a word that used to fascinate me, and still does, I think, because he reminded me of it. He said, there's a liminal place in our mind. Liminal meaning the doorway between worlds or between extremes, between the yes and the no. The place where we don't have to decide. We can just be with both sides. And the amazing thing is that our mind is able to do that. And often we don't realize it. It doesn't mean that we don't take a moral stand and say yes or no when we need to, but that every time we meet a situation, we can embrace the whole thing. And then, if we need to decide, we can come down. But not, as it says in the Metta Sutra, not hold to fixed views. That's the trick. Your favorite third patriarch always said, the great way is without difficulty, just don't prefer one thing over another. Or don't hold it so tightly that you can't change your mind if you have to. Buddha said that over and over. Examine everything within your own heart. Let your own wisdom tell you what's the right thing to do. Yes. Sure.
In the middle. It reminds me of two exchanges that come to the same point, which is we have to be able to go into the situation almost without reservation. I think I can see it myself. I'm constantly hedging. I'm constantly even our society says you're not allowed to drive the car without the insurance. That's a hedge. You're saying, so the kid who's 16, he says, I got insurance. I'll speed on the highway. I got insurance. In some senses, that's the exaggerated version. But you know, the exchanges that come to mind are, you know, the student and the teacher are talking, and it comes to the teacher says, when it's hot, be completely hot, and when cold, be completely cold. And the other one that comes to mind is somebody was talking to Ru Jing, who I guess was Dogen's teacher, and they asked, somebody was asking him about the breathing. And he said, in our practice, let the long ones be long, let your long breaths be long and the short ones be short. We can't even do it regarding our own breath,
yes,
let alone anything more serious.
Yes.
And I can constantly, those are just, you know, just examples, but how those stories just highlight how hard it is, you know, you're in a job, you're doing your job, but you're always thinking, well, gee, what happens if I had to leave? Mm. Or when you're not having a job, well, what are all the things I could do to make it as not, you know, risky or whatever as it is? You want a hedge, you want to have a backup, you want, and yet I can feel there's some value in that, but it also, I'm in a little cage. I'm being held back from living, when you said, what was it, you said something about not only seeing this awareness, but the next ring and the next ring, and then everything, no ring. And whenever you're hedging, whenever you have something in reserve, you're not living, in some sense.
Well, we have to take care of ourselves. So there's a level of our life that is devoted to taking care of ourselves. And that's preparing for the future in some sense. The lilies of the field is all very well, but we're not lilies. Even though on the most, in the absolute sense, it's true. We can completely put ourselves, surrender ourselves to the whole process of life. But our life would be very different if we lived that way. And most of us can't. So in a way, we're compromising. But if it's a compromise that's conscious of how we live and the choices that we've made, then it's not that we have to be so pure that we go all that way. We don't have to go all that way. It's being conscious of what decisions we're making as we're making them, and how we're being in the world. If we're hedging because we're protecting ourselves at all cost, and being very self-conscious, that self-consciousness that we were talking about before, then it's a losing game. Then we aren't living, you're right. But if we have to feed ourselves. Mm-hmm. We have to shelter ourselves. And there are ways to do that we have to know, mm-hmm. which is what our conditioning was originally about, to help us to do that. But then we have to know what it is that's driving us and how it's driving us. And how we understand it, whether we understand it as the great me, protecting the great me and making a castle, or being open to continual change and opening up as life continues.
I'm just reminded of how few people I've ever seen do almost anything that has that no ring of protection.
Open quality,
and,
yeah.
This is surprising. It's good coincidence that I happen to remember this one example. One time I was up at Tokoji, and Kogan was there. Mm-hmm. And I happened to be standing in such a way that I could see him bow towards the altar, and I was on the other side, the behind the altar. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's open up there, so you can see the person bowing. I've never seen anyone do something as simple as a bow as open as that.
Yeah.
You know, people, I see people meditate and bow all the time. Yeah. You know, I see people type on computers and do all these things. But that was an example. And I don't think he did everything that openly. I think that particular day, it was very obvious to me.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he was as open, maybe I didn't see it. But that day I definitely saw it. And all it was 3 bows.
Yes.
And it was like completely, he could have, there was nothing, he could have died after each bow. Mm-hmm. And you would have known the bows were complete.
He did die after each bow. That's the point. That was a big koan for me for years, because he lived that way much more than most people do. Much more. He just went as things went in his life. And I was completely involved in a family, as he was, and with a completely different attitude about it. I was, you know, I was anxious for one thing, trying to do it right, and he was just letting things come and go. And as I really looked at it as time went by, I could see that although he was free, he was completely supported by everybody and everything. He was allowing himself to be supported by a couple of millionaires, Steve Jobs being one of them. He just depended. He didn't, well, yes, he did. I was going to say he never asked for anything, but if he got really backed up, he would go and ask somebody he knew had a lot of things to give, and they were glad to give it. So it's not as simple as I mean, it's one thing to die at the altar, but dying into the world is more of a challenge, and it doesn't work in the idealistic way that we like to think it does, where we can simply not depend on anything. We do depend on each other, on our partners, our relationships. There's no way to avoid it. Even if we went out and lived in the woods, we wouldn't be able to live there without the support of others. We're always asking, how do we live this practice in the world? And it's it's a beautiful challenge, because it means our deepest understanding and our highest ideals are brought to rest in the middle of a kind of mess, the mess of everyday life. But what we're really looking for isn't out there. It's right here. It's right in us. Someone quoted a poem of Kabir, kind of chastising, saying, we have a ruby inside. There's a ruby in us. And so we don't even need to practice, and we don't need a practice place or any other people. It's just us and the ruby. And the friend that told me about this said, well, yeah, but the ruby shines if it's with other people. And that's the whole point, is the shining of us. It's how we shine and how we live from this place. this place of our own promise and our own fulfillment of our promise. In a way, it's nothing special. It's just what we know in our heart is how we are and how things are. But it's easy to cover it up or put it aside. And so, like Zazen, we just keep coming back to our truth over and over. Coming back to the place that includes everything, not one side or the other side. Julian?
I was kind of thinking how it all really does begin and end with sitting. Like, in sitting, we are supported. It's like this optimal balance of dependence and like what's inside and outside. Like, mm-hmm. See the problems when you're trying to different, like, draw the line. Okay, this is me, this is outside, and you know, I'm trying to negotiate. All right, so. It doesn't work.
No.
And so then I was thinking, really the most joyful thing is like sitting. That's in fact, I mean, it's like practical, literally like the case. I mean, not the best movie, not the best vacation, because even with those things, that's something outside. That, you know, I guess it's temporal. It's part of the five skandhas or whatever. I don't know that it comes and goes. I mean, not to say that, you know, people like going on vacation is a bad thing, but ultimately, sitting is that perfect middle ground,
mm-hmm.
That allows us to also start operating in the world in a more like balanced kind of manner.
Yeah. It's a gift.
I guess that's what they kind of mean by, like, the first enlightenment. Like,
yes.
It literally, I mean, that just the, you know, whatever experience you have on the cushion, just the fact of sitting, that's...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why they use such a strong term. I mean, that's a really strong term. Mm-hmm. We're just staring at a wall.
I think it was you. I was telling a story once about the little boy who was watching the sculptor. He was sculpting and sculpting off of a big block of wood, and finally he was done, and the little boy turned to the sculptor and said, "How did you know there was a lion in there?" Anything else?
Can I ask a procedural, not a procedural, a Zendo practice question? On Saturday, is this considered to be a mini sesshin, such that when we stand up, we don't bother each other?
Yes.
Okay. Today I noticed sometimes we were, sometimes we weren't.
Oh.
And so on a Saturday, it's considered a retreat.
Yes.
So we fluff our cushions when we come back.
Yes.
Proceeds.
Yes.
Whereas on Wednesday, Tuesday evening, it's regular, and we fluff our cushions before we battle one another.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you.
Yes, because we only do one sit in the afternoon. You don't understand.
It is.
Yeah. Well, you must have a lot of questions like that.
I feel like I'm watching a German movie where I understand one every 10 words or something like that. And I look forward to the day I understand one out of every 5 words.
Yeah. Well, as you can see, it's pretty simple at the same time, so it doesn't really matter. That when we sit for a whole day, it's very nice in sitting, if we sit more than one sit, to just, when the bell rings, just stand up and seamlessly continue the zazen mind as we walk, which is why we don't fluff the cushion and bow to each other. It's just staying where we are and continuing with very very small steps around the room, so that the zazen more or less continues all morning long until the one bell rings, and then it's time for the service. And it'll be that way again this afternoon. We'll have a couple of hours more where we can just stand and walk and sit and stand and walk and sit. It's a very nice way to continue and still take care of our poor knees, which need a lot of help usually, especially by the afternoon. And we bow to the cushion in gratitude, really. It's, as you say, it's what holds us as we sit. So we always bow to the cushion. And then we turn around and we bow into the room, which is to everyone, but it's also to everything. I mean, everything for which we feel gratitude. So much of our practice is about gratitude and appreciation, and also being conscious and aware. So that when in Sesshin, as we're walking back and forth in the breaks and we pass somebody, we stop and bow. Even though we don't talk to each other during Sesshin, we acknowledge and recognize each person, each Buddha. And the more we sit, the more we really understand and feel the Buddha-ness of what comes and goes in our life. So we have these gestures that accept and acknowledge our own deepening understanding as we live together. Much of what we do isn't talking. I always feel a little embarrassed to talk in the Zendo. It always feels strange after these long hours of not talking to make a yawp, as Whitman would say. But important to ask questions if you have questions, because it helps everybody else. Well, Samuel, why don't you serve the cookies? Thank you very much. She brought dessert.
She's trying to think of what to bring hot tea, so I decided just to bring water.
It's a good idea. And if anything occurs to you while we're munching and crunching, please bring it up.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
When pain starts coming up in the physical body and starts affecting your sitting, do you kind of push through it? Or, I mean, I know depending on what, but it's just all new stuff. Because as I'm asking the question, I'm thinking, answer your own question. It's your own body. It's pulling me down with my... It's like I feel the pain and I'm obviously not happy about it. And I guess it's part of growing old, too.
Where is it, Samia?
By the end of 25 minutes. So I probably need to change my... When I was at Jikoja the last time, I used one of the benches, and that was a little bit better.
I bet that would help. You can even do that on a cushion, you know. You can turn the cushion on edge.
Right, yeah.
And sit on your knees that way.
Right.
And that will help your hips also.
But that's... I mean, usually it's the knees, right, and the back?
Well, no, it can be hips, too. It can be. It just depends on how you sit, how your body is in the first place.
But I guess I was looking more for, it's like, how do you work through the pain?
Well, you can. It just depends on how serious it is. If it is, a pain is a signal. And sometimes in sitting, it's a signal that is kind of a false alarm. It's saying, let's just get up and go play.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't sit as much, you
know. Yes, yes. Yeah, it's an excuse.
Right.
And it's just a bored mind that wants to go and do something else. You can also develop a terrible itch that has the same effect. Oh, I've got this terrible itch. I just have to move. And, of course, you don't really. It's just a trick. Or you can see things on the rug as you're sitting or on the wall. You know, strange animals will suddenly appear or funny faces, you know, clown faces. It's just all, it's called makyo in Japanese. And it's just all mind tricks, your own mind is manufacturing all this distraction. Because there isn't any other distraction. No, we've taken all that away. So pain can be that. But it's also basically a signal saying there's something wrong. And so you need to find out. And if it persists, if you have it when you're not sitting, then you need to follow up on it and see what's going on. It may be bursitis. You know, that often happens in the hips. Or something like that. So take it seriously and kind of make a study. But don't hurt yourself. I know somebody who sat a whole session and vowing not to move one muscle the whole session. And she put out her hip in a way that has never... And that was 30 years ago, has never really healed. So you don't want to do that.
What about, yogic, exercises?
They're very, very, very helpful. And in some Japanese temples, they have a shiatsu master who... doesn't help the monks, but helps the abbot. The abbot gets all the advantages.
He served a lemon once.
Oh, thank you, Samia.
You want to take one?
Oh, no, once enough. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Drawing out of Samia's question, I don't understand bead barrier.
be the barrier? In what context?
Dido speaks about it a lot. And it sounds like you, it sounds to me like you, I don't know what it means. It sounds to me like you enter that pain somehow.
Mm-hmm. The best example of that I know is, I remember who it was, even a young man who sat a session in a lot of pain, in his knees especially. He was very stiff and had a hard time just being on the ground. And he was determined to do it, but he suffered. And after session was over, he came to me and told me that he had tried everything, tried different positions, tried. He and the pain were two different things. And finally, on the last day, he said to his knees, "God damn it, if you're going to hurt, go ahead and hurt." And it all went away.
Wow. Oh, like asking those demons to just stay here.
Yeah.
And they went.
Yeah.
But I don't... It's stopping to resisting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Becoming a barrier is stopping resisting.
Stop, and it stopped being two people. The one who has the pain and the one who doesn't want to have it. Excuse my bad language. It was his. I said, "Excuse my bad language."
I'm obviously a neophyte at all this, but in Vipassana, one can also sort of use, an itch as a form of as an object of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that when I'm in pain, quote unquote, if I sort of just focus on the pain and just feel it and experience it.
Yeah.
It sort of dissipates some of the anxiety, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so I guess the deeper question is, where does Vipassana end and Zen begin, or are they all one and the same, or what?
Vipassana is a kind of foundation practice for Zen.
Okay.
So it's the same.
Okay.
Yeah, it's exactly. If something's happening, it's what's happening. So that's where we are. We don't go someplace else and try to imagine something. We just stay present with what's actually happening.
And so my impression, and maybe misguided, is that Zen is really about watching things and letting it go, whereas Vipassana is about watching things and not holding on to a thing, but to really sit with it and just be totally aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you have an itch, be totally aware of that itch.
Yeah.
Am I making a false dichotomy here, or?
I don't think so. I think that's right. That it, in Vipassana, it's every experience is cultivated and named. Usually, you don't just experience the itch, but you tell yourself that you're itching. As long as it's happening, isn't that right? And eventually it goes away. The more you attend to it, that it doesn't stay. But in Zen, we acknowledge that something is happening, but we keep coming back to our breath rather than cultivating it. I think that's one of the big differences. With the same aim. Now, ours is more of a concentration practice, and vipassana is more the other way. But they go together.
Can I ask a question that combines what Nancy said and what Anhel said? So, Dogen's famous thing that got him his first big experience in the Zendo was when his teacher told him to drop off body and mind. And I think when I hear that, I take that in my head as a command, in other words, in the sense of when I'm sitting, practice, dropping off body and mind. And yet, when he went to his teacher and asked him, after that experience, how am I doing, the teacher reversed it, and he said, body and mind have dropped off, leading me to believe that the real experience of that is not you doing it,
right,
but observing the dropping off. So it, the component from Nancy's question is, where's the barrier? The barrier is that there's a difference between you thinking that the body and mind have not dropped off, separation, and being completely with the body and mind dropping off, which is not 100% you. And yet, we do create the barrier, and we can't fully be the dropping off, it seems, a lot of the time.
Well, if you practice with that as a goal, it's pointless, completely pointless. Best way to practice is without any ideas, because they're all just thoughts. You know, and we can cook up a lot of thoughts, but they're all just thoughts. They can be profound, they can be wonderful, they can be terrible. They'll just keep churning out thought after thought after thought. And we can hold up one thought as a great ideal and try to avoid other thoughts that are, you know, aren't so ideal. But the reality is, at the same time, is what's happening. Is your own breath, is your own blood running through your own veins? There isn't any I, and there isn't any body and mind to drop off. That's just a thought.
So Rujing, I mean, what do they call it? So that's an expedient means thing. I mean, Rujing saw what was going on and said that, and it happened to touch Dogen, because Dogen was right at that, he was right there. He was there to accept the words right then and there.
Some scholars think that Dogen misunderstood what he said. And I can't think what the other word is that they think. There's a very close to that word, to dropping off. It that means something much more benign and much less dramatic. And that that Dogen just got it wrong. So. So, of course, he used everything and tweaked everything. He used the Lotus Sutra his whole life and tweaked it. So maybe he just tweaked it on purpose. It's a teaching. But it is expedient means. It's helpful at a certain point. But if we start holding it up as an ideal and sit hoping that body and mind will fall off, we might as well go to a baseball game. No.
So better just to...
Just to sit.
Just to sit.
Yeah. Just to sit.
No barriers, wholehearted.
So
Wholehearted, yeah.
The impression I get from Vipassana is it's a lot more like guided. You're given some like instruction on go to here, and feel the sensations throughout your body. And Zen, it's just like they get the instruction just to sit. It's almost. It seems like mean in a way. Like, if you're doing it, like, I don't know, it's hard to find the words, but like, in terms of progressing, there is that possibility of sitting, of doing. You can't do Sazen incorrectly, and you could be doing that for a long time.
Yes.
And a teacher is not going to correct you, or at least that's my impression of like some of the readings I've done on the teaching method with Zen.
Well, yes. Well, of course, you can't see inside somebody's mind exactly. But you, no.
I've seen your. Oh no.
But a teacher can be very helpful. It's not because the teacher has some kind of inside information, but hopefully has some experience and so can reflect your experience and confirm it and help if there's some misunderstanding. But it is true, you can completely misunderstand what you're doing in Zazen and that's okay. You know, it takes some of us a lot longer than others to completely understand what the practice is.
I think it's such a big Zen cosmic joke, because when I first started to sit, and you said, here's the cushion, here's the posture, and that's about all there is to it. Like 15 years ago. There wasn't anything more she could say at the time, but that's all there is to it, is a Zen joke. Yeah?
Yes, but that's how you have to begin. You have to get into the water before you can begin to discuss swimming. You have to have the experience first. Then maybe we can talk about it a little bit. Yeah.
After 15 years.
We've done a lot of talking.
Yeah. It seems so simple and clear, you know. I mean, there's always questions, but then if you just sit a little bit longer with it, it's just really simple.
Yeah.
Is it that it's so simple it's for advanced students or even can begin with Zen? In other words, it seems the impression that I have of Vipassana is it gives you a framework from mm-hmm. which to begin,
mm-hmm.
and then you almost sort of let the framework dissipate,
right.
or recede into the background,
yes.
and then out comes Zen or something like that. Mm-hmm. It just strikes me as very, yes, simple, but very advanced in a way.
Yeah, some people call it the steep way. You know, it's going straight up the mountain rather than, carefully going the softer, easier way. Maybe so. I think some people are just made to want to go that way, to just plunge right in. It's probably about character or something like that. You know, there are different ways. The Vajrayana way is much more complicated. You have to do 100,000 prostrations, recite a long prayer that you have to memorize 100,000 times. There's something else you have to do 100,000 times too, before they'll let you begin to sit. And then you do all these visualizations, and it can go on for years and years before you're allowed to do Zazen. And they think we're nuts to do it this way. So it's... But the schools of Tibet, especially now the ones that have come to America, that are putting some of that aside, I notice, the Dzogchen ones especially, and saying, well, it's okay, let's do some meditation. So I think they're beginning to change that somewhat also in some schools. There are lots of flavors of Buddhism. There's the Pure Land too, where you go to church. There are pews and a preacher and hymns.
You're kidding.
Not kidding. You should go sometime. It's called the Buddhist Church.
Really?
There's a big one in San Jose. Beautiful big temple with tile roofs in Japantown. And you can go and slip in. And if you go at Oban in August, July or August, they open up the church and they give lectures inside. And you can look in the hymn book, and it's all about Buddha. It's just like, except for songs about Jesus turn into songs about Buddha.
The same melodies, but they...
I don't know whether they're the same ones.
But are they Eastern or Western music?
It looks Western to me. And they just pray to Amida Buddha. Their whole practice is to throw themselves on the mercy of Amida Buddha. And if they can recite Amida Buddha's name with perfect surrender just one time, they'll be reborn in the Pure Land. That's their belief. So that's another flavor.
You know what's scary is you think of this and you think of it a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking it's like, what would other people think about us?
Well,
it takes everything,
if you explore it in your mind about the way your own mind works, you can find elements of all of those practices in your own self. And it actually, Zen and Pure Land are considered to be two aspects of one practice, even though that sounds very strange. In Zen, it's called self-practice, and we're self-driven, so-called, and we determine that we come and we say, I'm going to sit now. And as we sit, as we sit, we begin to drop off body and mind, or drop body and mind begins to drop off, and we surrender our whole self to it. And in Pure Land, they come surrendered already, saying, it's hopeless, I'm a mess, there's nothing to do to help me except to surrender to Amida Buddha. But having surrendered, one becomes empowered. And so that empowered person and that surrendered person come together, and it's just one practice, really. Just two different directions to come to the same place.
How did it come to be? Who came up with it? Does it have any Christian flavor to it?
Shinran invented Pure Land.
Okay.
But it was based on a Chinese practice. I think it's just natural to the human being. And even in Zen, I think sometimes we come to the cushion determined and full of vim and vigor, and sometimes we come completely surrendered because our life is just such a hopeless thing that all we can do is sit. So it's in us. All of those elements are in us and work us and teach us, inform us. Well, it's 2:00.